Hello, interwebs, and welcome to another episode of Paul Owen and Dr. Witz's Colloquium on Games of Strategy by Dixit, Skeeth, and Riley. This is episode 11. I'm Austin Smokowitz, one half of Dr. Witz.
I'm Aaron Hanswitz, the other half of Dr. Witz.
And I'm Paul Owen of Dice Tower News.
On today's episode, we are in Chapter 11, The Prisoner's Dilemma and Repeated Games. So the Prisoner's Dilemma is perhaps one of the most widely known concepts when it comes to games of strategy, but it is worth lightly touching upon what a prisoner's dilemma is as we get into this discussion.
So as a matter of fact, as I was telling my wife about this chapter, we sort of launched right into a little bit of role-playing. So what's a puzzle?
That's the new one.
Oh no.
My wife and I have been arrested under suspicion of murder, and my wife being a murder mystery writer could launch right into this. So the notion is, there's evidence to convict us of something, right? Let's say possession of a weapons possession charge or something like that, right? But the police don't necessarily have enough evidence to convict us of murder. They don't really necessarily know who did it or care. But if my wife and I were loyal to each other, right? We both decide that we're going to deny having anything to do with the murder and we cooperate with each other. We say, well, I had nothing to do with it. And my wife says, I had nothing to do with it. All the police can do is convict us of a weapons charge. We each go to prison for 3 years. We get home in 3 years. But the police go to my wife and they say, you know, if you throw your wife under, or your husband under the bus, you tell us that he did the murder, we'll let you off in just 1 year and he'll do the time for the murder. She says, huh, 1 year and I get all his money? Yeah, that sounds pretty good. Meanwhile, I'm thinking, you know, my wife could be throwing me under the bus over there because, of course, the police have separated us, right? So, I say, hey, to the police, you know, I don't want her throwing me under the bus. Actually, my wife did it. And then if we both confess to the murder, the police are like, great, we've got everything we need. Throw us both in the slammer for 10 years. Everything's good for the police and bad for us. But that's the Nash equilibrium is I'm motivated to confess and reveal evidence against my wife. She's motivated similarly to give evidence against me. We rat each other out. We both go to jail for a long time. But not as bad as if one of us had been ratted out by the other and tried to deny it. So
and
that's kind of the prisoner's dilemma.
And what we're going to do in our discussion is we're going to standardize those roles.
Yes.
So when you choose to keep quiet, that's you are cooperating. And when you are ratting the other person out, you are either cheating, shirking, or engaging in a defecting strategy. But that's all the same cases. You are choosing to try to screw the other person for your own advantage.
Right. And the only confusing thing about the terminology, to be clear, is when I say I'm cooperating, that means I'm cooperating with my wife, with my opponent. I'm saying you and I are going to collude and not help the police. We're cooperating with each other. We're not cooperating with the police. And that doesn't mean it's a cooperative game. The book is clear about that, too. It's not a cooperative game. We are opponents who are choosing to cooperate in our strategies.
And this doesn't just apply to the prosecutor situation. This applies to any sort of game where you're facing that situation where either you have the incentive to, if you work together,
right,
it's better than when you don't work together. But if one person's trying to work nice and the other person's being mean, the mean person is going to do better than all the other options.
Yep.
But that leads to no one working together.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. That's the conundrum. And the strange thing about it, of course, is the Nash equilibrium ends up being worse for the players than if they had cooperated and done the dominated strategy instead of the dominant strategy.
Which, you know, that dominated strategy, if you're being very formal, people will call it Pareto optimal.
What is that called?
Pareto optimal.
Pareto optimal?
Yeah. It's the idea that if you add the payoffs together in the dominated strategy, the total payoffs from doing that is greater than all the other strategies for the group as a whole.
Interesting.
This is one of those cases where people talk about how you can't rely on rational decision-making to always result in Pareto optimal outcomes.
Yes.
Because it comes down to what the rules of the games are. If the rules are there that you are better off by stabbing people in the back, then you engage stabbing people in the back. Rational choice players are doing what's in their best interest. This does not necessarily what's in the best interest of a group or a society.
Right, which gets back to the idea that even though this is a prisoner's dilemma, many of the times we're finding examples where the rules of the game are created by individuals to be put onto other individuals,
mm-hmm.
Right? It is a construct.
And as my wife pointed out, a deliberate construct on the part of the prosecutors to put us in that conundrum so that we do what is in our own best interest and bring about a result that they want.
Now, what's interesting about this chapter is that after the brief setup, the rest of this chapter is about how to break out of the prisoner's dilemma and the various ways of doing so.
And I found this one of the most interesting chapters we've covered so far because of that.
Why is that?
Because I had always thought of the prisoner's dilemma as an inescapable trap, you know, that the only way it would work is if my wife and I absolutely trust each other and go against what our own self-interest would be because we each trust the other. In sort of a not the rational thing to do, not the game theory rational thing to do, was the only way to escape the prisoner's dilemma. And what this chapter kind of illustrates is that there's other ways to escape it.
So, sort of. Well, let's talk about how you escape the prisoner's dilemma. Because it's a great thing. Prisoner's dilemmas are popular things to show up in board games. Let's set up situations where if we cooperate, we can get a good payoff. But if we don't cooperate, it's a worse payoff. But if you start doing something to cooperate with me and I stab you in the back, I get away with all the goods. I mean, this is a common scenario in board games. We're talking about something like diplomacy.
That was the first one I thought of. Yep.
Which they actually call this a security dilemma in IR theory, international relations. That's how important they think of the prisoner's dilemma in IR theory.
Ah.
Which makes sense why diplomacy replicates it. Henry Kinchler would happily point out.
So, and I'm going to go ahead and launch into one of the first ways to defeat the prisoner's dilemma and talk about how diplomacy applies that. And that is, so the first one is repetition, where we're not just going to play the prisoner's dilemma one time. We're going to play it multiple times in succession. And the interesting thing about that, in my mind, is theoretically, one game is as good as another, and we would both default to the Nash equilibrium. We both defect from each other, except that in diplomacy, you can't win the game of diplomacy in practice and historically. You can't win the game of diplomacy never forming an alliance. And so you have to form alliances. And that is essentially a bond of trust where I say, I'm not going to attack you. You're not going to attack me. You can take that territory. I'll take this territory. And as long as you cooperate with one another, you'll both prosper until one of you doesn't. And so the interesting thing about that is the alliance is successful because the prisoner's dilemma is repeated for some indefinite amount of time. And if the game of diplomacy were infinitely long, presumably, that alliance would last for an indeterminate amount of time.
Well, a game of diplomacy can be infinitely long, so that's not a sufficient
case.
The problem with diplomacy is that it's not a true prisoner's dilemma because it's part of a zero-sum game.
Oh, good point. Mm-hmm. Very good point.
If we're doing classical prisoner dilemma.
Well, it's a zero-sum game among all seven players, but it's not a zero-sum game between you and me if you and I are allies and we're taking over the rest of the board from our opponents.
Until
we get to the point where the last two people in the game.
That is just a term of convenience for a time period. In the end,
right?
Eventually, diplomacy forces you to go after each other. This isn't like UFO or Cosmic Encounters where there are multiple winners in the game.
Right.
And even then, that zero-sum aspect of it makes it a challenge sometimes to strictly define games as prisoner dilemmas. But we can think of those scenarios, though, where in the short run, in a finite space where this takes place, and making that distinction between finite and infinite games can be important because, as you mentioned, if you play a game over and over again, you have a solution.
And I do think that it is interesting that the book does talk about this as far as repeated plays in a finite period of time and an infinite period of time.
Yes.
And the one thing they talk about is that if you have a finite period of repetition, if both players realize that it's finite, the moment where they go from both being able to cooperate to where they start betraying is, well, basically the start of the game, because you just kind of work backwards to the point of where you actually betray somebody. Meanwhile, in an infinite repetition game, there's more likely to be cooperation forever between the two players because there's no point where it makes sense to actually betray somebody with the thought of retaliation coming shortly thereafter. And what's interesting is that if you look at this in the sense of a game of diplomacy, Paul is right and Aaron is right. Because at the beginning, it is a zero-sum game, but in the beginning, there is enough to make it feel like it's infinite. But the point of players realizing that things have suddenly gone from infinite to finite is where the stabs start coming into play.
Right. And the question, knowing when do I turn on my ally?
Right. If it's like, okay, so we have both gone in Turkey and, you know, so Austria, Hungary and Russia, Paul, you and I, we've both gone in against Aaron, who's Turkey. But the question is, at what point do we say, well, we don't have to worry about him even anymore, even though he still has two pieces on the board and we start turning on each other?
Yes. Well, I think you're jumping through the experimental evidence in game theory. That section made a point that in the real world, people tend to cooperate in finite games until the game gets closer to the end. So even though we have this trick game theory that says you should be stabbing people in the back at the very beginning, because if you can't trust them at the end, why can't you trust them the turn before the end and the turn before that? And the answer is you can't. So when we see people play these games in finite settings, then that's the outcome. Although I'm going to push a challenge. I'm going to argue that diplomacy actually isn't a finite game, even though I just said it was. If you consider diplomacy not as a single event, but one of many board games you will repeatedly play with everyone there.
Ah.
So your relationships are not finite.
Right, which is just as the relationships amongst players is just as important as the game itself.
But we should talk about why infinite games work out so well. One of the things you can do with infinite games is you can start looking at people's strategies with repeated play. So because there's this opportunity for this Pareto outcome, if we can both do the dominated strategy and stick to it for a long time, it potentially could be better off for both of us in the long run than us just going and not cooperating, cheating every round. And if we can develop strategies in response to people cheating, then that might be enough to induce cooperation. And we typically emphasize two types of strategies. They're both trigger strategies. A trigger strategy is what you do in response to what someone else is doing. One trigger strategy is the grim strategy. The first time you cheat for the rest of the game of existence, I am going to not cooperate with you. I will defect every time. I will get my vengeance.
And I think this is where signaling becomes important.
Well, this is no longer a signaling issue. This is just a response function now.
I mean, okay.
You're right. If I need to credibly signal that I'm going to do this,
that makes that effective.
Although, here's the thing. Once you know I'm engaging in the grim strategy, that doesn't mean cooperation is going to take place. Do repeated play, you have to factor in what is the benefit of cooperating over time. What is the value of cooperating today is not going to be as valuable. Sorry, cooperating today is going to be more valuable than cooperating in the future. People value things more now than in the future for a variety of reasons. And we can calculate that. And if the discount rate, which is how much you're discounting the future for today, is high enough, even though you might have a trigger strategy of never cooperating again, it still might be in the best interest of the other player to cheat and suffer the consequence than to cooperate. And so even though the strategy exists, it's not a guarantee it's going to work out in terms of forcing cooperation.
Yeah, that was an interesting discussion in the book about taking into account the time value of money or time value of whatever the reward is in the payoff matrix.
Victory point salad.
Victory point salad, right. That if points now are worth more than points later, then you might be inclined to take the trade of a short-term reward at the expense of a long-term loss. It raised a question in my mind, though. I have played some games where, like, for example, we just played Isle of Skye, and the amount of money, which are essentially, money is what you get tiles with, and tiles generate points. The amount of money you have to work with early in the game is relatively small, and due to having a turn-by-turn income, you have more money to work with later. It isn't necessarily the case. It's not really a good example. It's not a prisoner's dilemma, but in that economy, more points become available later, and so you would be more inclined to sacrifice resources now in the interest of a better position later because there are more points to be had later. So that's sort of an inverse situation. But the time value of money is sort of backwards from that.
And that's why Isle of Skye is designed that way.
Sure.
Oh, I think for that purpose.
A technicality. So I'm not going to say that they were lazy. What I am going to say is, so there's two approaches. One thing is they're using real money. So if there was a change in those values, they'd account for it. That's one way you could say it. The other way you could say it is that it's theoretically possible that you do have a reason why future events are more important than contemporary events, and you actually have a discount rate with a negative sign on it. Yep. So mathematically, you can think about it that way. Right. And typically, when economists think about something like that, usually what they're talking about is there's deflation.
Yes.
Explain why you can have a negative interest rate at the bank. And you know, you can have negative interest rate for one reason, is that there's going to be deflation. And yes, even though your money would be more valuable if you hold it on as cash and put it in the bank, you know, at that point, you're probably just using the bank as a secure place to store money or for having these transaction costs. But they're not going to pay you more money for holding your money. They're going to take money away because of the deflation. But I do think you make a good point there, is especially in the board game world where you're playing a zero-sum game and really what defines the value of something is the victory points it buys you, whatever game design you have, it might be much more likely to experience a negative discount rate in a board game than in the real world.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, and maybe I don't want to go too far off topic, so stop me if I do, that in as much as most board games that we play are competitive, where ultimately some people win and there are other people and everybody else loses, in a way, they're all kind of zero-sum games. It doesn't matter whether I end up with 100 points or 20 and you end up with 1 point or 19. All that matters is that I won and you didn't. In a way, all games are zero-sum games. All competitive games are zero-sum games.
Gambling.
Yeah. Now, by gambling, do you mean poker? Or do you mean betting against the house?
I mean poker, or I mean even sometimes the way you gamble in Monopoly, you just assign a dollar value. Every dollar in Monopoly is worth a penny.
Uh-huh.
But
I've always wanted to do that. Play Monopoly. But except that the bank introduces money. See, but this comes back to my thing about...
A little bit.
Yeah. Really what it is, though, I'm going back to... The prisoner's dilemma is the prisoner's dilemma has an external source of punishment or reward separate from the two players themselves. So it's not a zero-sum game. But whereas most of the games that we design as board game designers are zero-sum games. So there's a limit, I think, to how the prisoner's dilemma applies to our designs and how this discussion about prisoner's dilemma applies to our designs. Now, I feel like I sort of mentioned diplomacy as an example where it does, because you have an alliance in the context of a larger game. But if it was just you and me playing against each other in diplomacy, there's no prisoner's dilemma there. It's just a zero-sum game.
Well, and it can be a strange zero-sum game. You know, one of the things you have to worry about as a designer, and you really saw some of the examples they have later in the chapter, is there's this great example where they talk about a union and a business negotiating with each other and whether or not they hire a lawyer to help them. And the point is that if you have a lawyer and the other person doesn't, you have a big advantage. But
yes,
if you both don't have lawyers or you both do have lawyers, the outcome's the same. The only difference is when you both have lawyers, you both have to pay all this large amount of fees to the lawyers that you wouldn't have to pay if neither one of you had lawyers. And it's very possible. Like I worry about when I look at some game designs now that they've introduced prisoner dilemma situations within their zero-sum game, which doesn't actually enhance gameplay. It just means if someone's not paying attention, they get hurt, but if you're dealing with experienced players, you just wasted their time. Because the outcome was going to be the same either way. They both were make the right counter. It's the same situation where that move had been there or not been there.
So before we go too much further along in that direction, I want to go back to the trigger strategies for infinite repetition. So that was the first one, the Grimm strategy.
Right.
And the second one is a little bit more famous, the tit for tat strategy. And the tit for tat strategy comes out of a contest that was held for people creating computer programs or algorithms computer programs to run against other programs on the prisoner's dilemma. And the one that came out ahead of everybody was a very simple concept called tit for tat. The program begins by being cooperative. And then if the partner decides to defect, then on the next turn, the tit-for-tat program will then defect and will then not cooperate again until the other program cooperated on the last turn. So it's a program that effectively looks at what you did last turn and then copies that.
And it could be to a bunch of different strategies. Some strategies that are very complicated and some strategies that are, actually every strategy is more complicated than tit for tat, except maybe a grim strategy.
And that very simple strategy found to work better against much more elaborate and complicated schemes that other players came up with. And then later on, there was a slightly modified version of that where you add in a little bit of forgiveness, whereby if someone defects on the next turn, you see if they defect twice before you defect. That did a little bit better than strict tit for tat, but the basic concept is worth talking about.
Well, it's simple. It's straight to the point. In fact, I love Axelrod's quote on the matter. He said, after doing all these competitions, that don't be envious. Don't be the first to defect. Reciprocate both cooperation and defection. Don't be too clever. And so long as you follow those four simple rules, you are going to do well in a prisoner's dilemma situation relative to everybody else.
Over repeated plays.
Over repeated plays. And that's really important.
And that's repeated plays against the same players, presumably?
Repeated plays against the same players.
I was just wondering, to what extent is the success of the tit for tat, is it strictly mathematical, or to what extent doesn't it play into psychology? Like, if I notice that when I defect, you defect on the next turn, and it undermines my defection on the previous turn, and I finally realize the best thing for me to do is to cooperate, or...
So that's the great thing about Axelrod's work. Axelrod just said, give me strategies and we'll run the numbers.
Okay.
What Axelrod shows us, if you're just doing with any strategy one comes up with, number-wise, this will get you the best results. You don't have to account for psychology. You don't have to account for sociology. If you just do tit for tat, basically it can't be beat. Doesn't matter what motivation is.
Interesting.
If you're facing someone who's really mean, you do better than their strategies. If you're facing someone really nice, you do better than their strategies. It gets you the benefits of being nice to someone while protecting you from mean people. And it becomes a critical thought process because I really think repeated play does exist in board games, but it exists as a metagame amongst multiple games. And so what I really enjoy seeing is that even though in an individual game there might not be repeated play, over multiple games there are, and you know when you play board games, you see people deal with other players.
Right.
I see Keith go after Paul, or what Paul did to him in the previous game.
Yes, that might happen.
Keith will remember that.
Funny you should mention that. Actually, it wasn't deliberate, but we're playing Steve Ball. And in the previous game, there are these things called milestones. You try to accomplish milestones by doing something pretty fantastic. And I managed to accomplish a milestone and trigger the end of the game one turn before Keith was able to accomplish a different milestone. Which, and of course, every game resets a lot of your game state. And so he had to go back and start from start to try to achieve that milestone again the next game. So the next game, we're competing for two different milestones. And he accomplished his one turn and triggered the end of the game one turn before I was able to get mine. Now, it wasn't deliberate, but it sure felt that way.
What was his response?
He laughed, of course.
Because he had just won.
And taunted, might have taunted a little bit. Might have been some taunting there. But yes, I agree with you that there is a metagame is part of it. I think people who forget that, you know, that's how diplomacy can have negative effects on people.
Yeah. Be good to your game groups. Everybody remembers.
Well, and I mean, Austin and I played a lot of diplomacy. Mm-hmm. And let's be honest, Austin and I have engaged in the grim strategy in diplomacy.
Oh, really?
There are a couple of players who you can never trust because in the end, they are always allies.
Yes.
And so the solution became, because we played diplomacy with them multiple times, mm-hmm. we can never trust you. You are the first guys that we're going to wipe off this board, no matter who you are.
Except it never happened. I don't think we were ever able to pull that off, though.
We were usually able to pick one of them off.
Yeah.
Which is really all you need to do.
It always helped if they were separated across the board from each other. That helped.
But that is something we developed for repeated play. Because they had repeatedly done this, we develop a trigger strategy. And gosh darn it, for at least some players, it triggered it. And some players might have been two nights. They didn't have a good trigger strategy.
So I thought it was interesting, too. There was a section about games of unknown length where you don't really know where the game is going to end. You know it's finite, but you don't know how long it's going to go. Then you have to factor in the probability that the next turn is going to be the last turn. And I think what's elegant from a mathematical standpoint is you simply take that into account in your discount value for the payoff from next turn, as opposed to the payoff for this turn, in your calculation of whether to defect or not.
And I think that's a really good argument why games should have a variable ending. Specifically, games that have these elements in it, it's not always necessary, but it helps add that extra layer of calculation in these types of games where you're like, well, do I need to do something now, or do I have another turn before I need to make a move?
Particularly when there is that opportunity for cooperation or betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, that's why the finite ending is so powerful. You mm-hmm. know, if the betrayal is going to happen, this is when it should happen.
Yeah.
You're in anticipation of it. Is the betrayal going to happen or not going to happen? This is where asymmetric information about the players is useful. This is why in Dead of Winter, it's important that there might be a traitor or there might not be a traitor. You know when that moment's going to be, and you know when you're going to find out.
Yes, when you have two morale left, it's like, okay, now the traitor reveals themselves because there's not a whole lot left to lose.
Now, another method of defeating the prisoner's dilemma was the penalty reward method. And I thought that was pretty good. We, going back to my discussion with my wife, she actually heard me laugh out loud at this section of the book. So we talked about it. It was, if I throw her under the bus, I rat her out to the authorities and I get out of jail in a year. But then all her murder mystery friends come after me after I get out of jail. And they all know how to make poisons and stuff. You know? Then my net payoff is not nearly as good as I thought it was going to be for just doing a year time in jail. And so what essentially she and her murder mystery buddies have done is modified my payoff matrix in a way that it ceases to be a prisoner's dilemma at all. And I decide to cooperate just to save my own neck.
And now when you say that, what I think is interesting about that concept is that I don't necessarily feel like that is a way to solve the prisoner's dilemma, because you've just changed the payoff matrix of the prisoner's dilemma so that it's no longer a prisoner's dilemma. So that's not necessarily a solution. It's almost like saying that the prisoner's dilemma is set up by the guards, by the police.
Right.
And the only reason it fails is because they're not taking into account the externalities that's particular to you and your wife. Right. They don't know that your wife has those friends who know how to make deadly poisons. If they did, perhaps they could say something about witness protection or do something else to keep the game stable.
Yes.
But exactly. We had this wonderful discussion, Austin. The whole idea about strategic thinking in games is the work to change the rules of the game so you're not playing the game you're going to lose at.
Right, but in that section, I will counter by saying that in that section, what was really interesting to me is that the payoff table never changed, just the way that you perceived that payoff table. Here, we are saying that you are changing that payoff table.
So I was just about to suggest that whether it's a prisoner's dilemma or not depends on how I, as a game player, perceive my payoffs to be and my opponent's payoffs to be. So isn't the definition of the game based on the perception of the player's payoffs and anticipation of payoffs? Isn't that at the heart of what defines the game and how the game's going to go? I'm struggling with the distinction you're trying to make, Austin, between the payoff and the perceived payoff.
And that's interesting because I've always seen it as the prisoner's dilemma is only a prisoner's dilemma because the police have you and your wife in separate rooms and they're offering you this deal.
Right.
And they're the ones making the rules, much like we are the game designers making the rules.
Right.
We still have to look at our participants as a little bit of black boxes, because even though we set up these conditions, what this section is specifically telling me is that even though we've set up these payoffs and punishments for our players, there are other things in their lives that may be going on that we're not taking into account that can drastically change the way that they play our game.
And right. I think that leads to the two good points. First point, just so we're clear about the payoffs, we always want to remember what things make it more likely that people are going to cheat. And Paul was alluding to that already. Is the benefit of cheating high enough that I'm willing to suffer the consequence for it? Probability that the game's about to end. The likelihood of people detecting my cheating, which can change the size of the payoff of cheating.
Right.
If you're talking about penalties and awards, their effectiveness is dependent on the likelihood that the penalty or award can be implemented and the likelihood that the cheating itself can be detected so it will be implemented.
I was just going to say about it being detected. That's the interesting thing about a game with secret ballots like Resistance. You can undermine somebody else's strategy and not be identified as a person who did so. And that, of course, affects your motivation as well. You remain undetected.
But if you're going to impose penalty awards, it's really important. Can you easily enforce the rules and detect cheaters? And if you can't, penalties and awards don't work. And we should emphasize, it isn't just a penalty. You don't just punish people. There are options you can award them as well for cooperating.
Yeah, if somebody rats out the mob boss and nobody knows who the rat was, then no amount of threats are going to make any difference.
And it doesn't have to be that Paul is being chased down by your wife's friends. It could be that since you didn't rat out your wife makes you this wonderful, I don't know what your favorite dessert is.
Cake.
Let's say cheesecake.
Let's say cake.
makes you a wonderful cake as a reward for not ratting her out. Although for this rework, you have to give her some sort of reward too.
Right.
And unless we're dealing with the leadership solution. We're not to there yet.
Right.
But we're about to, so why not talk about the leadership solution?
Oh, no, I don't want to jump there yet.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I want to put out two things there. The award or punishment either has to be done through a third party or through the group. Third party is something like a court system. The reason why I bring this up is the extreme case of Prisoner's Dilemma is that people may not like the way you play games.
Going back to the metagame example.
Metagame examples. And punishment for not cooperating isn't that they won't cooperate with you in future games. They won't play with you for games at all. It's possible that the punishment for not cooperating in board games, people to stop playing games with you. That's a real possibility. You think about some hardcore diplomacy players. Some people don't want to play games with people because they don't like the way they play games.
That's true.
Yes, you get voted off the island, as it were. You don't get kicked out. You just don't get invited back.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you do that as just a social group, you know, that's without a third-party enforcer. It could be you put that in the terms of rules of play for a board game convention, and the board game convention could be the third-party enforcer, and they just kick you out of the convention. But that is a real possibility of thinking about how you can have mechanisms to incentivize people to cooperate instead of shirk.
I was just going to say, I was thinking about something my dad said about the importance of truth in a civilized society and how society works because people tell the truth in court, for example, and because when somebody makes a promise, they keep their word. And to the extent that people fail to do that is the extent to which civilization fails. It got me thinking about how society works because in part, we don't do the thing that would necessarily benefit me most in the short term. It's, you know, so I could stand to make a lot of money if I broke into my neighbor's house and stole his computer. But, you know, even in the long term, whether because of the punishment of society or because that kind of thing doesn't last, because I know I'm in it for the long haul, I don't do that.
You just gave David Hume's argument on the formation of human society.
Oh, really?
Yes. This is why David Hume, one of the approaches to talking about the formation of the U.S. government ideas, instead of doing Locke versus Hobbes, you do Locke versus David Hume and Adam Smith. Because David Hume and Smith argue that societies form out of the need for cooperation for achieving what you just described. Out of our self-interest, we don't kill each other, not because of some Leviathan enforcing us, that's Hobbes, and not because of some allusion to a higher power, that's Locke. Locke is appealing to some idea of natural laws that govern society. Hume in particular is very explicit about this. We don't kill each other. We don't steal each other's stuff because I don't want you to steal my stuff. And if we did that, everything would fall apart. It's in our interest to work together.
And by the same token, the value of the dollar holds up because, you know, we all...
You mean fiat?
we all acknowledge the value of the dollar and accept it. If I ever came to the conclusion that the dollar isn't worth the paper it's printed on...
I got some nice bitcoins to sell you.
Right, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
I'll take that worthless paper off your hands.
Well, it only becomes worthless if enough people agree with you.
Exactly.
of, even if you think it's worthless, if enough people disagree with you, you can still get stuff for it.
True. Yeah. But conversely, it's valuable because enough people agree with me that it's valuable.
Or even if people disagree with you, it's valuable. Like you assume you think it's not valuable. If everyone else thinks it's valuable, guess what? It still buys you a car.
Right.
And of course, to finalize that tangent, as opposed to getting off into more philosophy on these items, we will come into another chapter a little later on that talks about these prisoner dilemma concepts as through the lens of like evolutionary elements instead. Mm. And I guess that'd be a more mathy way of saying if societies are nice to each other or not.
Well, and that brings us back to board games too. Something I want to think about a little bit, but really we should move on to leadership, is that when you design a prisoner's dilemma game, because there's these different responses to it, there's different crowds for it. There are people who are more likely to go, yay, prisoner's dilemma game, and there's people who are likely to go, ew, unless it's somehow packed in a nice, pretty way. I think we'll see more of that as we talk about the experimental side of things in leadership.
Sure, but then there's also the theory that if a player is sitting down to play your game, they are going to become the type of player that you are kind of nudging them to in order to win the game.
Well, that's exactly what we get to with the experimental results.
Exactly what we get to. So leadership.
Well, maybe we want to talk about the experimental results. New players are more trusting than experienced players. That's the big outcome. When you generally put new players in a situation, they're much more likely to cooperate than cheat, which makes me think, if you're designing a board game, are you designing a board game for new board game players who are probably more likely not to cheat on the person, or experienced board game players who it's the first thing we spot, let's be honest, especially with designers who are looking for these problems all the time. We quickly spot a prisoner's dilemma game and talk about it as a prisoner's dilemma game. Think about it as a prisoner's dilemma game, and we're much less likely to cooperate.
Try to, yeah.
All right, we'll go with the leadership. You guys are pausing there.
Yeah, leadership.
So I'll say that I think this one I had the least grasp on.
So
it'd be interesting to kind of hear your take on it.
So it feels to be another way of changing the payoff matrix based off of the people involved, in the sense that if you have somebody that's so high up in an organization. So let's say that it's not you and your wife anymore, but it's now you and your boss's boss, something like that, where they're much higher up and you're an easier fall guy. And
let's do something much more practical.
Okay.
Let's do something much more practical. You had a bad experience at a hotel, awful experience at a hotel. And
that can only mean bed bugs. I'm just saying, because that's bed bugs. Okay. So you got bed. So you got bed bugs at a hotel, and
yeah.
You have the ability to publicize this. Now we're gonna make some assumptions here just to make this fit a prisoner's dilemma.
Okay.
So for you, publicizing is the cheating. You'd rather not publicize about your bad experience because the evidence are like awful pictures of your body with bites on them. But if you don't publicize the experience, the hotel is going to cheat. In this case, do nothing.
Right.
In which case, you have the horrible experience, and the hotel gets away with it and doesn't do anything about it.
Right.
Or the hotel can go after you if you publicize this. It's not best for you. Not because if you both kept quiet for the hotel, but you know, you get to say your problem. The hotel gets to protect itself. Or you can complain about the hotel says nothing, in which case you cheat and the hotel didn't. And it's better for you, bad for the hotel. We can both work together. Okay, so that's our scenario. Here's the important part. The hotel has a lot more money to lose in all these scenarios than you do. It's still a prisoner's dilemma situation, but the hotel has a lot more money at stake than you do. And so the hotel is in the position, in essence, to give you a side payment to compensate you for not cheating.
Gotcha.
It can take a leadership role.
Right.
So when you're talking about leadership strategy, one player is disproportionately hurt or better off in this situation. One versus they have the resources where they can start paying you off to not cheat. Share with you some of the wealth that they've earned by you not cheating. The other story that talks to Saudi Arabia story.
You mean OPEC issues, yes. Saudi Arabia? Because they are the biggest member bloc and the biggest oil producer. They would have more sway over the bloc than everybody else.
Well, it's that they chose not to cheat.
Because they have more to lose if they do?
In essence, yeah.
If everybody
does. Yeah, exactly. So they have more to lose if they cheated, so they don't. Okay, yeah, that's the idea to tell about. So even though they are suffering because our country cheated, the benefits of them of not cheating is so great, they still don't cheat.
So let me give you another situation and tell me if this fits the same scenario. In a Columbo episode, there's a very rich person who has murdered somebody else, and a not so rich associate who knows that they murdered somebody else, but has done something else illegal. This is a, you know, they can both keep their mouths shut or they could rat each other out. But what happens is that the less well-off person says, I'll keep my mouth shut if you give me $50,000. Is that kind of a contrived leadership situation for them staying on the cooperating side of the prisoner's dilemma?
Yeah, that could be. Although typically, you know, when you tell these stories, it's more like the wealthy guy makes the offer to the poorer guy. But
yeah, whether it's bribery or extortion, either way.
Yeah. But yeah, that's the idea, is that I'm reaping more benefits from this cooperation than you are.
Right. So I can compensate you for cooperating, which you are not inclined to do. Yep.
That's right.
Yep.
Which is another externality brought into the game, which the...
Well, this actually leads directly to my board game design challenge.
Ooh.
So here's my challenge. My challenge here is to design a board game with this exact leadership scenario, where one player is powerful enough that they can pay off another player to cooperate instead of cheat. And the reason why I consider this a challenge is for the issue we brought up earlier. This is typically a zero-sum game. If I were to make you a side payment in a zero-sum game, the only reason I'd be willing to do that is that it benefits me relative to you. So for that exact reason, I would expect you not to accept it.
Right, because if I could potentially gain more than the bribe you're willing to offer me, then I would take that instead. Then I would do that instead of taking your bribe.
In absolute terms of the game and victory points. You know, if it's just a two-player game. Now, my challenge doesn't have to be a two-player game. That's how you're going to probably get around it. And it goes like this way. If I was willing to accept your bribe, it means, assuming I'm competent, it means I am gaining relative to you for taking the bribe. So why would you even be offering me the bribe in the first place?
Ah, if your bribe, or at least I'm suggesting that your bribe is too generous if I accept it.
Well, it implies I think maybe you aren't good at math.
Which sometimes happens in these games where people will throw out funny numbers just to see if they can get away with it.
And so I'm accepting your bribe because it actually helps me relative against you and improves my odds of winning.
That happened in Isle of Skye also. Yeah. Set prices on things and you can't do math well. I'll take advantage of that.
And so I'm looking for this mechanism to use, and not because people make a mistake with their math. I want people to design a game where you create leadership opportunities, even though the game at heart is some form of zero-sum game.
How much asymmetry do you see between players? Can not only within their relative valued positions, but also potentially their end game scoring? Like, they will still be a zero-sum game, but I'm looking at a slightly different set of victory conditions than you are.
No, that's a potential solution to the issue. I mean, the key thing for any trade game to work, and we had this whole discussion about Empire and trade before we started recording. Empire's the game by us.
David Stevenson.
Where the reason why it's such a good trading game is because players are so different. You're different because you have different resources at hand that leads to trades, or you're different because you have different objectives and that leads to trade. I mean, trade only can happen if there's something different between the players. If the players are exactly the same, with the exact same resources, exact same opportunities, and there's nothing that makes them different in some form or way, there's no incentive to trade. So to be a trade, and this is a type of trade here, agreeing to not cheat for a payoff, there has to be something different about the players to incentivize them to do that.
All right. So overall, Prisoner's Dilemma, it's a very big and broad topic, but I'm glad that we've been able to both highlight the interesting elements that we can bring into our board games, but also some of the limitations thereof when considering how to implement strict Prisoner Dilemma into your game design.
Well, and especially the idea, are you introducing prisoner dilemma because you want the players to be stuck in the prisoner's dilemma? Or are you introducing the prisoner dilemma because you want to see if they can apply these strategies to escape it?
Yeah.
As always, it's been a pleasure talking to both of you guys tonight.
Same here. And for reference, our next episode is going to be on collective action games. So thank you for listening to Paul Owens and Dr. Witz's Colloquium on Games of Strategy by Dixit, Skeeth, and Riley. You can find Dr. Witz online at dr.witz.com or on Twitter at drwictz.
And now on Instagram at drwictz.
How about that? And you can follow me on dicetowernews.libsyn.com every Monday, alternating with Elliot Miller. On Twitter, I'm at Paulo in Games. And on Board Game Geek, I'm PDO in 3.
Thank you. Have a good night, everybody.